So, but.
So I wanted to ask, did you have some part in the Fort McCoy Bluebird program?
Not so much. I mean, Kim Mello originally established that. And, you know, when I was a younger biologist, I helped, you know, check the boxes and band a little bit. But it's never really been a project that I was in charge of, per se. But I've had some involvement in it, and it's been a very successful program.
But it's run by volunteers now, I
yes,
think, isn't
yeah,
it?
Yeah. And, it, you know, we've got just under 300 boxes out. And on an average year, they produce 1,500 bluebirds out of those boxes, besides some house wrens, tree swallows, chickadees, and everything. So yes, it a tremendous program. So,
okay. One of the remaining questions I want to ask you was, when you were in college and you were, you know, just learning about natural resources and biology, how important is the biology aspect of the natural resources programs we have? When you're talking about you kind of already talked about the importance of what the Army does for natural resources because of the laws involved. But from a personal aspect, how important is it to understand the biology aspects of what this program needs?
Yeah. I think most young biologists think that's the only thing you're going to need to do. You need to know about the critters and understand them, and, you know, but it's about 50% people management and 50% managing the critters themselves, and, you know, knowing what their life requirements are, what, you know, kind of habitat they need, and that kind of stuff. But yes, very important to be able to do that. And the longer, you know, you're in a position, you know, just the more stuff you pick up over time, and you don't even realize until you know, like we have new biologists come in, or we have, you know, somebody, a job shadow comes or something like that, and some of the questions they start asking, you know, the stuff they don't know, and you just take it for granted now. You don't even realize you've accumulated all that kind of knowledge, and the one thing that you talked quite a bit about the Carner, and I think one of the most, you know, I don't know, the thing I think is one of the highest achievements in my career was back, I think it was about 2011 or 12, the command group said, you know, can you think about trying to be able to mitigate the loss of lupin that occurs on McCoy off the installation? And I started looking into that. And the reason they wanted to do that, because before that, I was going out and replanting lupin. If we had something that was called permanent take, like they built a building and it took an acre of lupin, I had to replace that acre of lupin somewhere on McCoy. But we had already met all of our conservation goals that were set from the Fish and Wildlife Service. We had enough carners on the landscape. We had enough habitat on the landscape. We had two different populations. So that made sense, you know, why spend resources here when there's other populations off the installation that before this butterfly can be delisted, they have to meet their conservation goals and everything. So I thought it would be through the Army compatible use buffer program that maybe something like that was possible. But I started looking into it, and one day I was trying to reach the person that was listed on the website for this Army compatible use buffer. And I left a message, and somebody else called me back, and he said, well, she no longer works here, but I'm her boss, you know, and it was a guy in the Pentagon. What would you want? And I described to him what I was trying to do, and he says, well, you really wouldn't do that under the Army Compatible Use Buffer Program. There's already existing laws and, you know, statutes that would allow you to do that. And he sent me the information. So then, and I ran it by our legal folks. And then I started talking to the Fish and Wildlife Service about what we wanted to do. And we ended up, because the Wisconsin Department of Natural Resources is managing carners on the landscape all over Wisconsin. Mm-hmm. And most of their sites, they haven't met their conservation goals yet. They either don't have enough butterflies or enough habitat and that kind of stuff. So we worked out a deal between the Fish and Wildlife Service and the DNR where we could send, and it cost us so much an acre. Like if we had 5 acres of habitat that was permanently removed, mm-hmm. it was $3,020 an acre, I think is what the cost is. So we would send a MIPR to the Fish and Wildlife Service because they could accept a federal MIPR from us, because at that time we didn't have a mechanism to go right to the DNR. they would turn around then and transfer the money to the DNR to do work on some of their areas, whether it was surveys or habitat work or whatever. It had to be tied to the Carmer. But the beauty of it was, as soon as we transferred that money, we were off the hook then for any of the rest of the work. But it worked well because, you know, in theory, every time I was replanting lupin, who knows what's going to happen on the military installation 10 years later. They might be doing something there that has to take their lupin again and everything and stuff. It made more sense, since we had already met our conservation goals, to send that money, eventually get it to the DNR, because again, the butterfly isn't going to get delisted till they meet all of their goals and everything too. So, and I happened to, 6-7 years ago, run into the guy at a meeting that I talked to at the Pentagon that day. Really? He remembered the conversation. And I explained to him how well it was working and everything and what the cost was. And he said, man, that makes me feel good. But he said, have you shared that with others? And I said, yeah, a little bit. Well, you got to make sure you let others know about that, because you're the only one that I'm aware of that's doing it that way and everything and stuff. And he said, too, keep doing it, because nobody else is doing it that cheap. I mean, I can't believe how cheap you're getting it done and everything and stuff. So we ended up giving presentations at the National Military Fish and Wildlife Association. John Noble gave when we won the Fish and Wildlife Service Partnership Award in 2019, they asked us to give a presentation at the National Wildlife Society meeting on partnerships. So he went out that and, because he had done partnerships with the Fish and Wildlife Service and some of the stream work, and then he also reported on this too. So we tried to get the word out, but it made me feel really good that this guy, you know, again, how successful he thought we were at doing that. And
it's amazing that he remembered your conversation.
Yes, and eventually now the way we cut the middleman out, the Fish and Wildlife Service, because they charged us a little bit for their admin stuff. Now through miscellaneous pay, the DNR pays us directly. We like, just in the last couple of weeks, Jessup sent them a bona fide need statement and all this kind of stuff with how much lupin we were going to take this year. And then they send an invoice to us, and then miscellaneous pay pays that amount to them. And the price hasn't changed since we started this in 2013. The DNR keeps saying, well, we're going to have to up our price eventually, because they got to look, you know, they didn't figure in the long-term management on their properties. It was more to establish it. But so far, they haven't upped the price at all and everything and stuff. So, again, I was pretty proud of that, because it was a win for the Army. You know, eventually, it's doing us...
It's a win for Wisconsin, too. Right?
Yeah, it was really doing us no good to replant the lupin here, because, I mean, again, we wouldn't want to get rid of 1,000 acres, but it's a couple of acres here, a couple of acres there. We can live with that. But that money then is being a lot more beneficial, being spent by them to up their habitat and their Carner numbers and everything and stuff. So it's been a win for the training, and it's been a win for the butterfly itself and everything and stuff. So.
And I know you and I have talked about this before in doing some stories. When some of these training areas get reworked and you take out some of the extra trees and you have more grass growing and you have this savanna look, which is natural to Wisconsin. Tell me a little bit about the work you've done in enhancing those savanna, lupin-like friendly areas that's been done on Fort McClure.
Yeah.
I see them all over the place.
Yeah, we've actually just done that in the last couple of years around the Badger Drop Zone, because the Badger Drop Zone, it not only has some Carners out there, it isn't our best place for the Carner, but it's the regal fritillary butterfly. It's one of the better spots on McCoy habitat areas for that. The Otto Skipper, it's one of the best. And the military wanted to have more drop time, you know, coming across. So we ended up clearing several hundred acres just to the east of the Badger Drop Zone. So now when the airplanes fly in and they're doing their drops, they got 4 or 5 more seconds of drop time as they're coming. We've also been very fortunate, though, that they're still, even underneath the scrub oak overstory and that kind of stuff, there's a lot of native prairie plants there. So once you remove that oak overstory and do a few prescribed burns in there and everything and stuff too, we haven't normally had to replant at all. The seed bank is still there, the plants are still there, and it just responds to that being opened back up. You look at aerial photos from McCoy from like the 30s, there's a lot more tree, there's a lot more forested landscape than it used to be. but it hasn't been that long, so that if you remove them trees now and start burning, it's still there and it responds wonderfully yet. So we've been very, you know, fortunate on the effects we've had on the ground by doing that kind of work and everything.
What's the name of the savanna area that we were talking about before? The oak
well, we got, yeah, most of our savannas are oak savannas. There's some, if there's enough jack pine mixed in, it could be a jack pine savanna too. But we've got, like, the Badger Drop Zone is more of a prairie landscape, but then it degrades out into savanna habitats on each edge of it and everything too. And the other thing, you know, you don't realize, cause, you know, I, again, worked my whole career here. And to realize how, you kind of forget how special of a place it is. It was probably 7-8 years ago now, the DNR, they had hired somebody to do lepidopteran insect surveys throughout the state on their state natural areas. And they asked us if he could come out here and do surveys. And I said, well, yeah. And everything. So I ended up meeting him, and he had another entomologist with him the first day they showed up. And I met him at the north end of the Badger Drop Zone. From the minute they stepped out of the vehicle, he said, there's that species, there's that, you know, and they were like kids in a candy store. And he's done a lot of surveys now. He's been hired to come back on McCoy. He just was here last September. He came back with three other entomologists again. They actually parked a trailer down on the south side of the Badger Drop Zone and did some surveys and stuff. But I was that first year, because he had never seen an Otto Skipper before. This guy does surveys all over the place for the Michigan DNR, Minnesota DNR, and Wisconsin DNR, but he had never seen one. So we were trying to find one of them that day. And we started our survey along this road, and there's another skipper called a tawny-head skipper, and they're really common on McCoy, especially that year. And he got about 100 yards away from the truck, and I looked over at him, and he's just standing there, kind of with a smile on his face. And I said, well, what's going on? He said, well, I've already recorded like 89 of these tawny-head skippers, he said. And on a good day on a big prairie in western Minnesota, I might see 3 to 5 of them an entire day. You know, and he said, this is unbelievable, you know, but just all the different species he's seen. And then he had said too, you know, I bet you from what I'm seeing, I could document 12 to 1500 species of butterflies and moths just from this Badger Drop Zone if I was here all, you know, throughout the season. So that's why he's picking different times every time he comes back. And he's over 500 now. He was just here this fall, and he sent us as his report, but he sent an email first that, yeah, I had another, I'm still working on it, but I ended up finding a few new species that are, you know, state record species, haven't been documented for. And he gives the scientific name, so I didn't even know what it was. So I looked it up, and when it popped up on the screen, it said thought to be extinct. You know, wow. So, you know, so some of the species that are out here, just, again, it's a very rich environment again, partially because most of it hasn't been farmed per se, or, you know, there was all, even back when there was little bits of farming going on, there was enough native habitat that wasn't being disturbed. And even the, when you look back at the photos from the 30s and 40s, the farm fields now, they're just, again, they're native grasses and, right, you know, everything and stuff, or trees now too. But so
and speaking of, like, the past, you know, one of the things that you brought into play here at Fort McCoy on staff was the archaeology aspect.
Yep.
I know we've had archaeology going on here for decades, but when you were coming on and you brought in, I think Ryan's the third archaeologist you've had here, as a staff member. But, I mean, talk about the importance of, we have literally spots on the cantonment area even that are ancient Native American sites, where we found arrowheads and just pottery pieces and all kinds of stuff from 2,000 years ago.
Yeah. Well, and it's even, again, was because those, you know, back in the late 1990s and early 2000s, it was that proactive management. Again, there's very few installations. We've had phase one surveys done over almost the entire installation. Again, obviously, some of the impact area you can't survey because of the danger and that kind of stuff. And there's a few other places too where there are known cemeteries and stuff they're not gonna go. But the majority of the landscape, they've done that phase one survey, so they know if there's a site. And then if certain ones, they went back and did the phase two surveys on them and everything stuff too. So when you talk to other installations, that's pretty rare. Every time they're going to do a construction project, they normally have to go out and do that phase one and two ahead of time to see if anything's there. We already know where most of our sites are, and not that some weren't missed, or you know, sometimes a new site is discovered, something gets disturbed, and you look, oh yeah, there's flakes there or whatever and stuff. But the majority of them are known now, you know, which is a really advantage for planning training or planning construction and that kind of stuff too. But yeah, it is amazing.
Or building habitat.
Yes. I can remember, I just talked to him this morning, to Brent, about this. He was one of the cultural resources guys here in the, you know, about 2010, but how excited he was one day in one of their pits, they found, you know, this old pot and everything and stuff. And so again, it was like a 2,000-year-old pot when they finally got it out of the ground and did the dating on it and everything and stuff. But just to see the excitement in him for finding something like that. But, you know, they'll find the old, I mean, as a biologist, I would look at it and not even recognize it as something special, but they can see where the Native Americans had their campfires and burned because of the charcoal stain and the sand and that kind of stuff. And they can do the radiocarbon dating and get the age of the site and everything and stuff. So, yeah, they found some pretty interesting stuff out here too. But again, we've just been fortunate. And I, you know, we've been funded fairly well our whole career. And who knows now? I mean, the government, they're talking about downsizing and everything. What's going to happen? But you know, we had that funding and we were proactive on it. So again, we were able to do those phase one surveys and get the whole installation done and that kind of stuff. So it's we were able to be proactive on our management and everything and stuff. So it's been really beneficial to be
being
that
proactive is good all the time.
So,
and one other thing I wanted to ask you about was the invasive species program. You've had a big part in that as well, and I think it was you who got us part of the Monroe County Council who overlooks that, and we have a little field day here every year. Just talk a little bit about the importance of the work that's been done to control invasive species here as well.
Yeah. Well, again, that was kind of interesting. I can remember when I first started working here in 85, nobody talked about invasive species. And I think it was about the summer of 1987 that we noticed a plant out in some of the Oak Savannah areas. What's that pretty yellow plant out here? Well, it ended up was leafy spurge, which is an invasive plant. And that kind of started it. So again, Kim Mello, give him a lot of credit, because he was fighting to do management before anybody else was even realizing it was going to be an issue and everything and stuff. And so trying to get funds for something like that when nobody recognized it was a problem, so he was trying to convince a lot of people all the way up the chain. But, and I can remember then a lady from USDA came out here because she heard we had leafy spurge, because they were working on trying to do biological controls, release insects to help control it. The insects that control it over in Europe control it here. So I was giving her a tour of the one day so she could see our habitat, and she said, oh, you've got spotted knapweed too. And we were down by the housing area at the time. And I'm a young biologist, what's spotted knapweed? Well, that's another invasive plant. We backed up and looked at it. If we had only